Welcome back to Pod in Action with me, Tariq Hussain. Good to join you again. I'm sorry it's been quite a break from our last pod. I took a little break over the summer, and then I've been lining up some fantastic speakers to talk to you over the next few episodes. I'm really pleased today to have the opportunity to talk to Professor Simon Gregory, who is the HE Deputy Medical Director of Primary and Integrated Care. He has quite a list of achievements worth looking up. Started out as a GP Dean and then moved to Postgraduate Dean, and now has this national HE role, really driving forward the strategic direction of primary care. We had a wide-ranging discussion, focusing on lots of areas: value added in medicine, whole system solutions to things like recruitment. We tried to keep things very real, not talking about how wonderful everything was, but you know, looked at some of the issues that we are facing at the moment and the tough times that we're going through in general practice. But it's fantastic to hear about the things that Simon is up to nationally and how he is trying really hard to make a difference with primary care and thinking, you know, clearly and focused on the future of a specialty that we think is really important. And that's why we do what we do. So I'm really grateful to his time. I think it's well worth listening. We have a little section at the end on thinking about something called a freedom to speak up guardian. If you haven't heard about it, it's something that we need to be thinking about in primary care, probably at ICB level, the integrated care boards. But that was an interesting little aside right at the end. I'm very grateful to Simon for taking time out of his busy schedule. He had some TV interviews to do after talking to me, so I appreciate how busy he is. And I think it's definitely well worth a listen. Later on in subsequent podcasts, we've got some other fantastic speakers within KSS coming up, so please look out for those. As always, drop me a note. Let me know if there's anything more that you're hoping to pick up on. For now, I hope you're keeping safe, keeping warm, and coming right up is our chat with Professor Simon Gregory. Thank you. So I'm absolutely thrilled today to be joined by Professor Simon Gregory, MBE, who's the HE Deputy Medical Director for Primary and Integrated Care. And really thrilled to have Simon on to be able to talk to you all, because the work that he's doing nationally really leads on several different areas that we're trying to do for HE South and for KSS. And so it's a great pleasure to have you on, Simon. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Tariq. Thank you for inviting me. It's great to be with you.
Do you want to just introduce yourself to the listeners and maybe just tell them a little bit about yourself and your role and how you got here?
Yeah, by all means. Although the first thing I'd say is, and it's really nice of you to introduce me as you have, but my aim is really for my work to support general practice, but largely be invisible to general practice, because actually they don't need to be bothered with people like me. They just need a viable workforce and they need to feel supported. It shouldn't be about me. So I will introduce myself, but it'd be great to talk about the work really and acknowledge the great work that our GP and general practice colleagues do, really in quite difficult times at the moment. Mm-hmm. So as you've said, I'm Simon Gregory. I'm a GP in Northampton. And in the King Edward Road Surgery and the Grand Union Primary Care Network. That's named after the canal, it's not egotism. And I'm HE's Medical Director for Primary and Integrated Care. The name's a bit outdated. It was that before integrated care systems came in. It was about the integration of primary care and community care. So really, my responsibilities are general medical practice primary care, and therefore the GP specialty recruitment and some support to the ARRS roles. I'm an Essex boy, so I have to say that slowly, otherwise it comes out very rudely. And Then I'm also responsible for dentistry, staff and learner well-being advocacy. We don't have a significant role there, but we're advocating for it. Freedom Speak Up Guardian, doing quite a lot of work on trying to support our international medical graduates. We've got a team working on that and really doing some good work there. And I'm Freedom Speak Up Guardian. There's a few other bits, but you don't want to fill the whole podcast with me going on about myself when I said I wouldn't. So I hope that's enough for now.
That's great. Tell me about the sorts of priorities that you've been working on and that you think that we should be focusing on within primary care.
I think that we need a sufficient and sustainable workforce. Mm. GPs are working, GPs and their teams, I should say, are working harder than ever before. Over a million consultations a day. Mm. I read in the social media this week and in the mainstream media, my friend Dr. Gandalf, who I'm sure many people know, talking about on occasions doing more than 200 episodes a day. That's just crazy. That's just unsafe. And that's no criticism of him, by the way. He's a fantastic doctor. I mean, that's all my colleagues are working beyond what they want to be working. And I think that sucks the joy out of general practice as well. And I think it gets in the way of the relationship. So my priority is a sufficient and sustainable workforce. And to be honest, the main thing that's going to do that is actually sorting out the working week and retention. And those are not my current remit, although perhaps we might talk about changes coming over the next year and how that fits. But for now, it's GP specialty training. And really there, I've got four priorities, I suppose. The first is getting the numbers right. Yes. And we're actually talking on the day that we've announced exceeding our recruitment target for the fifth year in a row with 4,032 trainees, which is really great. And amazing. In that, can I just say thank you to you and all our training colleagues, because when we went up to that number, I remember one of my primary care deans saying, that's impossible, but a fantastic challenge I'd love to have, because we know we haven't got the capacity and yet we desperately need the workforce. Yeah, so exactly. I know that people have bent over backwards and really appreciate it. But so that's the first priority. The second is that we need to expand even further. Actually, we've got 1,500 extra medical students coming out of medical schools, including from the new Kent Medical School.
Sure, yeah, KMMS.
They come out and will enter a foundation program next year. And they were specifically targeted towards GP and mental health. UK medical students use general practice less than they do some other specialties, and I really want to encourage all graduates into general practice, but we need to capitalize on those new medical schools. So we need to further expand. And I would particularly
And like I think it was that. One of the remits of those new it medical is. Schools to focus on primary care.
Absolutely. So I'm hoping that they've had a really good experience of primary care. They've also was to recruit locally. I believe that Kent County Council supported some local students.
Yes.
There's a tool on GMC website called Data Explorer. It shows that something like 56% of doctors train within 49% of doctors stay within 10 miles of where they train in general practice, and another 36 within 50 miles. There so we've go. Got to train people locally. We've got to train people in under-doctored and deprived areas, as well as the well-doctored and less deprived areas. But we've got to start addressing remote, rural, coastal, the deprived inner cities. Margate needs GPs just as much as Canterbury needs GPs. And I think if we can work together to distribute the growth elsewhere. The third priority for me is addressing GP training itself. I think the joy's been sucked out of that at the moment, but we're about to publish a reform report on how we want to deliver GP training differently to help be more sustainable for the future. And then I think the priority then is doing that amongst the multidisciplinary team and how the model of general practice will work for that and what the skills of GPs need for that. And I think that's probably enough to be going on with for priorities at the moment.
No, that's really interesting. Thank you. And I want to pick you up on a couple of those areas. I thought it was important how you described general practice, primary care, medicine being focused in areas of need, areas of deprivation, because that historically was the idea of medicine, to be focused in areas of need. I trained at Guy's and St Thomas's, and Guy's was in an area of deprivation. Now it's very, very fancy. But I think that the same goes if you look across the primary care suite nationally there, and certainly Kent has quite low numbers of GPs per head of population. And that is something that we're trying to address, I know, you know, through various schemes.
We need to work together to address it. I can't address it from, you know, an office in Birmingham or London. We need to work together. There are 9,000, I'm rounding figures up and down, but I don't want to appear too geeky, but there are 9,000 general practice buildings in England. 1,000 of those are pre-1948.
Yeah, you're right, wow.
I think that will probably mean a terraced house, because pre-1948, it was the front room or the parlour of the GP's house. Even in my own practice that was built in 1994, you know, we've converted every single room we possibly could. You know, I did the COVID vaccination clinic out of what was meant to be a store cupboard.
Right.
We've long since extended as far as we could at ground level, and now have extended as far as we could building above that.
Mm.
And we've got no space left. That's in an urban area. But if you go to, remote parts of your region, there will be a dearth of practice estate. Also, if you're in an under-doctored area, getting the headspace to say, yes, I've got the capacity to take a trainee is really difficult. And yet the trainees stay where they train.
Yeah.
So I think we've got to work together to support development of training where we don't currently train.
Yeah.
Continuing to value those trainers we have got, because actually we've got to expand. This is more. This is not saying we're going to take away from some to give to others.
Sure.
But also, a lot of my colleagues have retired for a multitude of reasons: health reasons, the hostility from mainstream and social media, and indeed some patients, and pensions. But many of them didn't want to retire and have got many skills. So I think we've also got to look at whether we can support some recently retired GPs to be either as educators or mentors for the practices where we don't currently train. In the sort of 60s and 70s, our predecessors really raised the standard of general practice as they raised the standards of training. But if we go back further than that, Chris Whitty has a map that he shows of infant mortality rate in 1850. He then overlays the map of excess mortality in wave one of COVID. It's the same map. Well, very, very similar, which means that we haven't done terribly much. Now, we both know as GPs and what we had in medical school, but through general practice, that it's the social determinants of health that really matter.
Yes.
But I think through GP training, through our careers, and with an approach of social justice and accountability, we can work in partnership and we can work to improve the health of communities. And actually, coming back to KMMS, they've been encouraging local children to go to their medical school. If I believe it's housing, it's nutrition, it's education, it's sanitation, etc., that will improve. But you know, I'm a working class Essex boy who decided to be a GP at age 11. No one from my family had ever been to university, let alone have the audacity to go to medical school. The life I've had has been through the education that I had. And I think if we can train at undergraduate and postgraduate levels in our deprived communities, and some people stay in those communities thereafter, and there is evidence they do, then we can really improve our society.
Yeah, which is what we're in it for. And such a nice thing to hear, because I think what we're talking about, Simon, is a whole system solution. And I was at a protected learning time event yesterday, and the focus was on population health. And I think sometimes I think that training has got away from that sort of culture of the population and the community and become very much about the individual sitting there in the room, trying to get their recordings, you know, trying to get their capabilities. But it's much wider than that. And I always used to have that time with trainees, you know, 2 or 3 months after they'd passed everything, where we could focus on those wider determinants of health, which I really enjoyed, but maybe which we didn't always assess, you know, down to the nth degree, or needed numbers on, or, you know, needed assessments on. But I do think that that was an important part of GP training.
It is, and actually population health is one of the work streams of our GP reform programme. But before moving on to that, though, the thing you've picked up on there, though, is also the impact of assessment. When I did my studies as a medical educator, one of the aphorisms you learned was that assessment drives learning.
Yes.
That was taught as a positive. I actually don't think it is. At the moment, we need assessments. I'm not sure we need the assessments we've got. I certainly don't think we need the RCA. And that's no criticism of the college for that. The college stepped up very quickly when the alternative was a cohort or multiple cohorts of trainees wouldn't have been able to complete and get their CCT. Yeah. But they are working on a replacement, and hopefully that will be fairer. Ultimately, I chair the AMI International Postgraduate Committee, co-chair that. And we advocate that it's time to review whether examinations are necessary. Mm. You know, some of the examinations have been running for hundreds of years.
Sure.
Even the OSCE format that's been running for less time was challenged during COVID. And I was at a conference this summer when people were challenging whether the evidence was it made any difference by changing some of those things. And the advocates were saying, oh, well, it raises patient safety and standards. I'm not sure that's been proven. I think that's been one of those holy grails that people have sort of held to, but without ever actually proving. And at the moment, workplace-based assessment isn't up to standard, but I'd like to get it to the standard when we don't have to send people off to examinations and we actually say, do you know what, you're a good doctor. I did have an international medical graduate colleague challenge me at the weekend that was fine for me to say as a white UK graduate because people didn't question my ability.
Yeah,
and that was a bit of an eye-opener to me, and that's why it's really important to listen to colleagues and their concerns, because I see differential attainment and therefore had assumed that my IMG colleagues would be the ones who'd say yes, please scrap it. What they said is no, we're going to be discriminated against thereafter, and at least we can say we've done it. So I think where I've got to from that is I don't think we need high stakes examinations that tear the joy and the learning out of general practice. But we do need valid assessments that enable people to say, you know, I am a good GP.
Yes. And a good GP probably means things like being good at supervision for you, for your colleagues. And,
yes.
And you know, some of those, as you were saying, are roles that now we expect to be working alongside our GP trainees in practices and definitely alongside them in their working career.
Indeed, but in that, we're going to need a different model of general practice or of how the GP works. So when I joined King Road Surgery, my predecessor was a fantastic GP who'd actually been my own GP, a guy called Mike Warmore. And I said to Mike, what do you regret about your career? And he laughed and he said, giving up ear syringing. And I laughed because I thought he was joking. And he said, Simon, I'm not joking. It's the only time I cured anybody and I didn't need my brain. And I was reflecting that early on in my career, about 1 in 3 patients came with more than one problem and with multiple complex problems. And often there were things that we said, that doesn't need a GP, that was a waste of an appointment. I remember having pads on my desk where we had to tick whether we thought appointments were necessary or not. My dad chairs a patient group in the village, he lives in Essex, and he said, isn't it terrible all these patients DNAing? I said, no, Dad. No, I love a DNA. It means I might get within 45 minutes of running on time. And when I did my trainer video, one patient came with 3 problems. Everyone else came with 1 problem. And all the trainers laughed that I'd chosen to show the patient with 3 problems because they said that's impossible. Well, I'd say to each of your listeners, can you remember the last time a patient came with less than 3 problems?
Absolutely.
Or even you'd be joyful if they came with only 3. I think we're dealing with much more intense consultations now. The the simple stuff, often the joyful stuff actually has been given to others. So I think we need longer consultations. And actually, I think patients, there's research evidence from people like Pereira Gray and the St. Leonard's Practice in Exeter that shows that if you give longer consultations and can use those to achieve continuity of care, you end up needing less appointments, get better patient outcomes and better satisfaction for the doctors. It's hard to think of that when you're on the hamster wheel running as fast as you can. But you can't do 6 10-minute consultations an hour with e-consults coming in, results coming in, and 5 people all wanting you to supervise them, and a paramedic ringing to say that they've got somebody that's they've visited and they don't think they need to go to hospital. And the trouble is, Tara, you and I know that I haven't just made that up. That's our reality, and that isn't sustainable. And we've got to find a way working as PCNs and with our ICBs to say, we've got to have a model of general practice that is sustainable across the working week and across the careers. And I led the workforce section of Claire Fuller's stock tape, there being In Your Own Patch. And we need to remember that stock tape was written for ICB chief executives to help them understand what they need to support general practice. So it was written in terms for them, but there is much in that to help us if we just look for it. It is there.
And I think you've used the word 3 times now, but I think what we're talking about for millennials, people coming into primary care, is putting the joy back in, because they don't want to be necessarily doing very, very simple things, but hundreds and hundreds of them, as you say, 30 or 40 contacts of straightforward coughs or colds. They probably want to be getting to the root of complex problems, but then you need time to do that and you need resources to do that. And as you say, I think one thing that I've always pushed for, and I'm very fortunate to be a partner in a practice and I've been there for some time, is that when you get to know people and you understand them and you understand where they're coming from, you understand what their home situation is like. I mean, goodness, when did a GP trainee last have an opportunity to do lots of home visits and get to know what someone's home looked like? But it's so valuable that actually subsequent consultations, they're much easier because you know them and you sort of know where they're coming from and where you want to go to. So I think putting the joy back in is something that I'm gonna take from this discussion that we're having.
Well, and I think also we might even need a name change. I've been against this for years, but especially with the advent of the proposal for SAS grade doctors in general practice, patients need to know the difference. I think we need extra workforce. And I do think if you can do 3 years of a biomed degree and 2 years of a PA course and work in general practice, but you can do 6 years of medical school, 2 years of foundation and 4 years of GP with extension, and not end up in general practice, there's a bit of an inequity there. Now, that's probably a whole podcast in itself. We could probably debate that one. But if that's all happening, and if we are now the person dealing with the ambiguity, the uncertainty, the multiple comorbidities in the patient's context and knowing them for years, we are the family physician, but I'd say more than that, we're the expert generalist, or actually we are a specialty. VTS was scrapped in 2007 and replaced with GP specialty training. We still use the old term because we love it, but it's GP specialty training. We are specialists, and I think it's time for us to be called consultants in general practice. And then like a consultant in hospital, we are supervising a team. We are the conductor of the orchestra. There is joy in that, but maybe also, it's not my business to be doing the GP contract, but on a consultant contract, you have a job plan.
Yes.
And that job plan will include clinical sessions, but it will include other things that count as general practice. Why is it that a half-time partner in my practice is working more than 40 hours a week, so more than full-time as far as I'm concerned in comparison to the rest of society, and yet it's classed as half-time because we only count the clinical sessions that she does? And I really think we've got to do some reframing. I had a patient last year who, and I can't use the rude words that he used to me in the consulting room, but he seemed to imply my parents had never been married. And he asked why us lazy GPs weren't open yet. He was in my consulting room. I won't give you the whole story. I can make that story last about 5 minutes because I kept trying to ask him what on earth he was saying. I think my consulting skills left me at this point because I just couldn't believe what he was saying. But there's a bad narrative out there, despite the fact we're all working so hard and doing such a good job. And I think for me, those early stages of COVID, we didn't close. My practice didn't close. My town didn't close. They even set up a hot hub at the university in the centre of Northampton. But also, we adopted Accurix overnight. We were doing phone and telephone consultations, phone and video consultations. I think partly the reason they worked actually is we'd got long-term relationships with those patients. And not only did they trust us and us them, but I also knew the ones that I wasn't happy to just trust doing it over the
phone. Sure. Yes, yes.
Or that I knew them long enough that they didn't sound like they sound normally and something was up. And I can think particularly of a mum with a son with autism living in a 11th floor tower block flat. He needs the curtains closed. And by the time I talked to them, they were freewheeling, you know, where you don't know day or night. You know, I think it took knowing that family to know how to help them. Yeah. And that's one of the bits, it's the essence of being a GP.
And coming on to a slightly different but related topic, I know one of your interests is in well-being and what we can do to look after ourselves. We're talking very much about a general practice that we're trying to envisage, a primary care for the future, in which the individual practitioner is valued and doing work that they enjoy and have joy. But there's also a piece for well-being in that, when you were describing that sort of consultant's working week, that's this job planned, that there needs to be a recognition that the work we do is difficult and well-being has to be part of that.
Yes. And I think there's the difficulty has been because, and I'm a firm believer in the partnership model, but because of the partnership model, it's been believed that well-being was general practice's problem, not anybody else's. But much of it is in the design and in the contract and in the ways of working that are expected of us. But then I think we can be supported to support each other. So one of the bugbears I've had over the years is that there's an NHS staff survey that says how staff are feeling in the NHS each year doesn't include general practice. Now, the good news is one was piloted last year by colleagues in NHS England. Piloted and instead of using the main NHS one because of the differences of general practice. So my ideal would be one staff survey. A survey doesn't sort well-being, but it does mean that people might notice that well-being is not, we're not happy and healthy in general practice as well. I think we've also got to get better at looking after each other. So the GMC data would show that 13% of exits from the profession are due to health and disability, and 13% are due to pensions, or approximately 30% both. I hear a lot of discussion about pensions. I don't hear a lot of discussion about health and disability. One of my friends and colleagues, Dr. Lucy Henschel, talks about this a lot. She's a GP up in Anglia. And she talks about how hard it is for people, for GPs that develop health problems to stay in or get back in. And often it's partnerships that say, we can't carry you any longer. Because if you're a small partnership and someone's off sick, that makes the workload is unbearable. We need to find ways around that.
Yeah.
But then I do a lot of talking with junior doctors or doctors in training. I don't like the term junior doctors, they're adults. We mustn't infantilize them. I talk there about let's get the basics right, treat them as adults, respect their need for a life, but also get their pay right, let them have time off for their own wedding, that sort of thing.
Yes.
Now, it's a bit different in general practice than that, but I think there are things that we can do. And some of them are, about how we organise our working week, how we reward, how we value. But some of it, is possibly simple. In my own practice, the partners, I'm not a partner there now, I only help out, but they started having a box of fruit delivered each week. And that's both healthy eating, but it's also telling people they're valued. But then actually one of the trainees for one of the MDTs turned up with a huge cauldron, almost, it was such a big pot, of lamb curry.
Wow, okay.
And she said, I wanted you all to eat the food that I would eat at home before I came to the UK. It was the most delicious meal I think I've ever eaten. But what she was doing is saying, I want you to know a bit of me. Mm. That led to a competition in the practice, actually, with each week, who could outdo the previous week and bring things in. Now, we didn't manage to meet for lunch each day like some people claim they do. In fact, it was amazing that we actually managed to meet. So it was amazing how quickly we found the time to attend the MDT when you could smell the food throughout the building. Nice. So yeah, I think some of it is the circumstances are rubbish. I keep saying to people, I love being a GP. I just don't like general practice as it is at the moment. Mm-hmm. And I think that together we can, I'm not a Pollyanna. I'm not going to sit here on the podcast and say it's actually much better than we all think it is. Because you know what? It isn't. Mm-hmm. But without general practice, we've got no NHS.
Yeah.
Primary care is at the heart of universal healthcare, and at the heart of addressing health inequalities. And I want to fight for that.
Yeah, it's definitely worth fighting for. Absolutely. Coming on to our one of our last topics, Simon, because I know your time is valuable. One of your roles is as a Freedom to Speak Up guardian. And it's something that I understand how that works in secondary care, but I understand it's something that we need to be thinking about in primary care. And I thought this might be a good opportunity just to run something up a flagpole, let practices, PCNs, educators think about what a Freedom to Speak Up guardian might look like in primary care.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm the Freedom to Speak Up guardian for Health Education England. That is for HEE's own employees. It's not for anybody else in the system. But there is a website for the National Guardian's Office that lists where there are Freedom to Speak Up guardians. They are meant to exist in general practice. But let me go back a step. Freedom to Speak Up guardians were advocated by Sir Robert Francis after the Mid-Staffs inquiry. Mm. And there he had heard of people that knew there were problems but were not being listened to. The role of the guardian is to be there for someone to speak to confidentially, to discuss their concerns and how they might progress them, because people often don't know where to go in the system. Or they're in a culture that is so toxic that they can't talk to anybody. And it's important that disclosures are protected under the Employment Rights Act, so people's employment is protected. But also that people are helped to navigate it. So the role of a guardian is to thank the person for speaking up, to listen to them and to help them work through their options. From the start, there was guidance on those existing in general practice. That guidance was that they were meant to be at PCGT and then CCG level. My own practice decided to have one before I became a guardian. Well, I can't claim any credit for it. It was one of my former partners that did it. But then for years, we'd always had a model of senior partner or chair, because we used to have a model, and a staff partner. And the staff partner was like an independent director that you could go to if you couldn't talk to the senior partner or the practice manager. So I think you can do it within practice. But now I think it's time for ICBs to work out how they offer this. Because if you talk to, I was talking to Rosie Benneworth, the former Chief Inspector of General Practice. I was mainly moaning about my practice's CQC rating, which we thought should have been outstanding. And we're not competitive, but we don't like getting anything. And she said often when she sees decline, it's in a whole area, not just in one practice. And that to me was really powerful.
That's interesting,
actually, it's often the system that we work in.
Yes.
Whether that be the commissioning system or what's going on at our local secondary care providers or mental health providers.
Right. So a whole area, meaning the practices, but also the secondary care around.
Well, she was only looking at primary care, but I would say that I think when there's generally, you can get problems in one practice. You know, you've got five partners on the doctor's practice and one retires and another one goes off sick.
Yeah,
well,
sure.
How on earth you deliver outstanding care in that, I do not know.
Yeah.
But often it is the whole system around. Yeah. It can even be that social care has collapsed where you are.
Yes, definitely.
You know, so I think... it's really important that we have that means of speaking up. And I know the guidance is being rewritten by the National Guardians team within NHS England. But I would encourage people to look at the National Guardians Office website. It's easily found on multiple search engines. See what we can do to support each other.
Yeah, I think that would be really good. Well, something that I just wanted to raise just to get practices thinking. Simon, thank you so much for doing this. I'm going to let you go, but I'm going to ask you a fun question to finish off. I know that you enjoy your rugby. What would you say you would take from rugby and want to put into primary care?
Yeah.
Nothing too physical, I'm sure.
No, and certainly we won't go down the line in hookers. I think it's when the team works well, everybody knows what their role is in the game plan. They trust each other, and they are adaptable to the unexpected. And I think when general practice works well, that's what it does.
That's fantastic. We'll stop there. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tarek. Lovely talking with you.